Tiger Woods is in a bit of trouble, hunker down in the cold and win in what appears to be a long, tough battle against Nick O'Hearn.
Thank you and good night, Tiger.
What a way to do it. 3-1.
I've been here before, I've played him before and beaten him before.
Tiger Woods and Nick O'Hearn are headed to sudden death.
Nick O'Hearn has this to win.
Yes! Oh! Nick O'Hearn once again is a Tiger Slayer.
And he looks like he's aiming right at it.
That's good. Oh, this is great. He's got it!
Oh, what a shot! Oh, what a shot!
Hello and welcome to Tour Mentality Golf fans. It's the second episode of Nick O'Hearn's Crackerjack book come to life in podcast form. I'm Matt Cleary and I'm joined, of course, by the great Nick O'Hearn because, well, it'd be a funny old podcast if he wasn't in it. Nick, of course, is the 20-year tour golfer who's moved full circle from teaching pro to player and back into mentoring folks how to play based on the lessons he learned himself over 20 years on professional tours in Australasia, Europe and the United States, and he did rather bloody well at it, if you don't mind. How are you, Nick? How you been hitting them this week, mate?
Oh, I actually haven't hit too many. I got out and hit a few balls yesterday. My back's been playing up, which is unusual for me. I really don't have many back problems over my career. So went to the physio, got it sorted, and back in action from now on.
Were you much on the weights? You don't look like a real gym junkie type. Well, there wasn't much fat in you, but did you go and work out? You didn't hit the ball very far.
No, I don't. I still don't. I went to the gym throughout my career more as a maintenance type thing. It was never a big priority for me to build up muscle or anything like that. I relied more on the old mental game and what we talk about today.
Right, a small bit of housework, folks. If you'd like to ask Nick a question, get on to myself by emailing matt@mattcleary.com, or you can front us on the Twitters. Nick is at Nick O'Hearn. I am at Journo Matt Cleary with one T. Use the hashtag AskNick. Also, both on the Facebook, and Nick has a website, nickohearn.com, with a contact page where you can ask him stuff. Any questions you have about the mental game, we'll do our best to factor it into the show. We've got a couple from a couple of listeners today. Look, you can also get onto Nick's clinics via his website, engaging for a corporate day, or just pretend you're Tiger Woods and pissed off about the intro to our podcast. Seriously, anything you'd like to know relating to the mental aspects of golf, get in touch, hashtag AskNick, and we'll have a crack. No question too stupid, though, well, some questions might be. Nick, what's the stupidest or funniest thing you've been asked?
Well, stupidest is usually the old, well, why do you stand on the wrong side of the ball? being a lefty, although now that I've converted to right-handed putting, I don't really get asked much that anymore. So, yeah, there's probably been a few weird ones over the years, but I try and blank them out of the old memory.
There's a chapter in that probably as well for Tour Mentality 2. Anyway, right, last episode, sports fans, we talked of the pre-shot routine, what Nick calls PSR, and there was a decision element for a D, and there was execution element, and there was a heap of good oil in that. And I urge you to have a listen. It boiled down to asking yourself, what do I have to do right now? And then there was stuff like staying in the present, committing to process, and seeing a movie in your head and executing the shot, and some really good stuff. Have a listen. Now, this week, we're going to talk about accepting the result, conquering first tee nerves, keeping swing thoughts simple, preparation and grinding in the Middle East, which sounds raunchy than it is. Nick, you were known as a grinder on tour, weren't you, mate? Which is a compliment from your peers there. It means a consistent player and something, you know, you hung your hat on as a player, didn't you? Being a grinder?
I did, yes. Nice comment there, grinder in the Middle East. there's actually a chapter on that in the book. So, yeah, it's, as you said, it sounds sexier than what it really is. But I prided myself on being quite consistent through, formulating structures throughout my career, which really helped me play in a very solid and steady way. So there's certainly nothing wrong with being a consistent golfer, which, funnily enough, most people now, it's the question they always ask. They say, how can I be more consistent in this game? So, and that boils down to a bunch of different things, which we'll work our way through as we keep talking.
First up, last week we talked about some thoughts pre-shot. This week, post-shot, immediately after hitting a shot, be it good or bad, how long do you gaze at it with admiration or swear at it or something in between? What's your, I suppose, your immediate 10 to 20 to 30 second thought process after that ball has done what it's done?
If it's a good shot, yeah, I probably maybe admire it a little longer than certainly if it's a bad one. I try and get that out of my mind as soon as possible. As far as time frame goes, I'd say there's probably a good 10 to 15, 20 second sort of evaluation period that goes on, thinking, okay, was that where I wanted to hit it? You know, did I execute a good process? Things like that. And then that's basically the finish of that one and time to switch off and then either chat to the playing partners or the caddy and then try and forget about the game for a little while. So I always found that if I lingered a little too long in that state of evaluating it, it sort of messed me up for the remainder of, I guess, the walk between for the next shot. I think the less time you spend on that, the better. But if it is a good shot, hey, you know, stand in the pose, wait for the photographers to take that picture and feel pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, so you're allowed to enjoy it, aren't you? I mean, the game of golf is about enjoying it. So you are allowed, wow, that was bloody good. Right, in your book, you use the example of missing a short putt on 18 at Coolum. That would have won the Australian PGA tournament in 2006. And you use that as an example of accepting the result, but man, it took a fair while. I'm sure you were, and you were, kicking cans all the way to the score of shit. Many golfers can empathise that they take their negative feelings into the next shot. Can you give our amateurs a tip for acceptance, for moving on, for not walking down the fairway, you know, stewing over your last poor shot?
Yeah, the acceptance part is really a matter of, I guess, evaluating the shot fairly quickly after you've hit it, taking into account whether it was good or bad. And the real key to it is to switch off. And if you've executed a quality process, it's probably easier to do that because you're okay to think, oh, well, that was a nice shot. Let me have a chat with my playing partners. I'm feeling pretty good. But when you hit a bad shot, the hardest thing is to stop evaluating it and switch off because you start stewing about it as you walk down the fairway. Now, as I said, most golfers probably have an easier time to switch off when they hit a good shot. But if you can do it when you hit a bad shot, that's when it really pays off. And that's where accepting the shot comes into it. So maybe in your next round of golf, after you've hit a bad shot, make a point to have a chat to your playing partners, even though it's probably the last thing you want to do. Usually we go off and stew about it or, you know, kick ourselves in the nether regions and sort of have a good talking to ourselves. Whereas the best way to go about it is actually get out of your own head and start talking to other people, and that takes your mind away from the game a lot quicker.
Yeah, so what I took a little bit from that as well was that if your pre-shot routine and you've gone through the process and done everything right to hit a good shot, you can still be sort of happy with yourself even if the result's bad. You can still be have not take pleasure from it, but understand that you've done everything to happen. You've done everything to make the shot good. It's gone bad for whatever reason, but you sort of almost have nothing to do with it, if you like. I mean, if that makes sense.
Exactly, yeah. I think, and that's where you have to accept the fact that you're only human. I mean, sometimes you can hit a perfect putt from 3 or 4 feet and it just doesn't go in. That's golf. So there are extraneous factors that come into it every now and then. You might hit a lovely drive down the left-hand side and it takes a horrible bounce and maybe kicks into a water hazard or into a bunker, and all of a sudden you're looking at going from making a possible birdie to a bogey or a double bogey. So that's all part of the game. And I always found if I executed the processes to the best of my ability, whatever the result happened, I was okay with it. You know, there may be an instance or two where it doesn't feel great, but that's all part of golf. So if the process wasn't so good, then you just put it down to, well, okay, I'm human. I can't be perfect all the time. Let's move on and try and do it better next time. And I think when you have that attitude going around a golf course, it just sort of frees you up a little bit more mentally, and the game becomes a little bit lighter and a little less stressful.
I like the anecdote in your book about a professional coming into a locker room and telling everyone, you know, why he'd shot 76 and explaining it shot for shot and complaining, and no one giving a stuff except his caddy and his wife and 140 pros overhearing him wishing he'd shot 77.
Yep. I think very true.
I think the lesson there is an understanding, you know, self-awareness that no one else cares if your shot's a good one or a bad one necessarily. That's a nice lesson. Explain that a bit more, better than I just have.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, when most people are playing in their local club comp or might be a club championships or whatever, it's just a game with the mates, and you get on that first tee and you're kind of feeling a bit nervous and a bit jittery. You know, expectations are pretty high and you feel as though the world is absolutely watching you. And you know, if you're playing in a President's Cup, well, then sure they are. But if it's your local club comp, you've only got your mates around you and they're sort of playing with you. And to be honest, they really couldn't care less. They're probably just a bit as nervous thinking about what they're trying to do. So the old story of the pro going into the locker room complaining about how he shot 76 to everyone, well, pretty much everyone else was hoping that he would have shot 77, not 76. So the point of it being, yeah, no one really cares. It's more in your own mind than anything.
Firstly, jitters, very common ailment amongst golfers, can happen to an amateur on a Saturday morning on medal day, or Rory McIlroy at Royal Portrush in his home Open Championship. You copped a massive dose of first-tee jitters in the President's Cup of 2005. You'd qualified for the President's Cup team. I originally thought you might have been a wild card, but you were there on your own bat. Mate, you partnered with Tim Clark of South Africa, a tough little player, a real competitor in the foursomes, and you're playing against Phil Mickelson and Chris DeMarco, who, I mean, he had a real purple patch, didn't he? Probably around the same time as you in those mid-noughts. Look, and it seems on my reading that you almost thought, how does little Nicko Hearn, the two-marker from the Mount Lawley pennant team, get here on this stage, and it sort of all became really big and that sort of thing. Mate, talk us through your nerves on that tee and how you conquered them.
Yeah, it was a pretty big moment in my career, to be honest. It was at a point in time when I was playing really well and as you said, made the President's Cup team, and it was my first one. We're in Washington, D.C., I think on the Wednesday night before we started. I had dinner at the White House there, and I thought, this is pretty good. I'm feeling pretty good about myself here. Yeah. No problem at all. And the opening morning matches was foursome, so an alternate format,
yeah.
meaning one guy's got to tee off the odd numbers, another guy's got to tee off the evens. And Tim Clark and I were on the range sort of going through the golf course thinking, oh, which tee shot suits you? And we come to the conclusion that I'll take the odds and he'll take the evens. And I never really thought too much about it.
You didn't think odd was the first one? One was an odd number.
Yeah, I didn't really twig at that point. But as I'm walking towards the first tee, you can sort of hear the crowd building and growing and the noise getting louder and louder. And, you know, I've been nervous plenty of times and I've had my hands shake and things like that. But as I get onto the tee box, I get greeted by my captain, which was Gary Player, you know, the South African legend of the game. Standing next to him is Jack Nicklaus, who was my idol growing up. I mean, I just thought, you know, this guy was the bee's knees. And watching him win the 86 Masters was one of the reasons that I wanted to turn pro. So he's standing next to him, and I'm, you know, the old butterflies are really going now. And then next to them is Presidents Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. And I stood there thinking, what the heck am I doing here? This is not good. And as I'm looking down the fairway, kind of visualizing what I'm meant to be doing, all I can see on both sides is the gap getting narrower and narrower. You know, the crowds are like 10 deep on both sides, and all of a sudden it looks like a one-way street rather than a pretty generous fairway, which it was when I was playing the practice rounds. And it was at that point that something happened that really hadn't happened very well, only one other time, and it was my knees started shaking. Ah. And when your knees start shaking, that pretty much means, I think it's the step before you pass out. So I had to get a hold of things pretty quickly. And fortunately, as I spoke about in the last podcast, it's all about awareness in those situations and being aware of how nervous you are and what you're feeling. And I was able to get my mind out of that by asking myself that question I always ask myself, which is, well, what do I have to do right now? You know, I know my knees are shaking. I feel nervous as all heck. How do I hit a quality golf shot here? And when I got my mind to start thinking those thoughts, then I got into the creative side of my brain. So I started visualizing a nice draw up the left-hand side. And I'm pretty sure my knees were still shaking, but I sort of had forgotten about it all and stepped up over the ball and gave it a rip. And thankfully, I didn't pass out in front of Jack and the rest of them. Yeah, it was an interesting time, to say the least.
So the little lesson there, I imagine, is trying to take a big situation, if you like, a big occasion, and break it down into compartmentalize it and break it down into a small, you know, just exactly what you got to do, focus on, you know, and just again trying to, again, you know, say block out everything else. But I suppose you're also acknowledging exactly everything, but break it down to brass tacks, which is set up over the ball and hit a little draw and get it on the fairway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, when you feel nervous and you feel that pressure, it's because you're focusing on a result.
Yeah.
And that's all pressure is. It's a thought about a result. So you all of a sudden usually the result you're thinking of probably isn't the best, especially when you're starting to get nervous. You start thinking about all the bad things that can happen. So the heart rate goes up. The adrenaline starts pumping, and all of a sudden you're probably in a physical state that you really don't want to be in. Now you can channel that in the right way by getting your mind into a positive state, and how you do that is to get out of that result thought. It's about focusing on the process. And then you can use the adrenaline to your advantage because, on that tee shot, I think I hit that first one further than I ever have. I could have probably dunked a basketball right there and then if someone had thrown one at me. So that's how much adrenaline was running through the veins. So you can channel it in the right way, but it all starts with how you think and how you and getting your mind back into that present moment. That's really the key.
And how'd you go from there? You've got off the first tee. Was it just a round of golf? Obviously it's a President's Cup.
Staggered off the first, and these are still going a bit. But we had a great match. Unfortunately, Chris and DeMarco and Phil Mickelson, they got us one up, beat us one up on the last hole. So, the day didn't work out as planned. But we had a great match, and Tim and I went on to beat a couple of the other American boys later on in the tournament. So it was a fun week.
Right. A listener and a good mate of mine, Podgy, who's a six marker out of Long Reef where I play, asks in the hashtag Ask Nick section, and this relates to your sort of keep it simple, stupid principle of swing thoughts. Podgy asks, Nick, do you take specific swing thoughts from a practice session in which you might be working on a number of technical matters out onto the course, or do you just go out and free flow and hope the best feel sticks?
So I've used two swing thoughts or what I call swing feels throughout my career, and they're very much feel-based ones. Usually if I'm working on technical things on the range, that's more about positions and areas I want to get through, with the shaft and the face angle and things like that, or how I want to move my body and things. So the two swing thoughts or swing feels I've had throughout my career is, number one is complete the backswing. Pretty simple, just make a nice full turn, because I always found if I didn't, I got a little short, it got my sequence out of order. And when I felt as though I was doing that pretty comfortably, the other one was just simply to hit through the ball. I think a lot of golfers out there tend to hit at the ball, so they don't pick up the speed at the correct moment, which is really through the ball. My coach always sort of said to me, look, try and feel as though you're swinging the club down the fairway, almost through the target, like a pitcher in baseball would throw the ball through the catcher in that sense. Or, a cricket batsman might hit through the ball rather than at the ball, to speak. So I used those, and they were more just feelings in my swing. It wasn't so much a thought. I always found if, when you start thinking in the golf swing, you tend to get more than one thought happening. So I tried to keep the mind fairly blank, but that feeling is something that really worked for me over my career. Now, people out there might have different swing feels or swing thoughts. The key really is just to keep them simple and keep them more based on rhythm and timing and sequencing. I think that would be the best way to go about it.
Nice. Yeah, well, Bubba Watson comes to mind. We'll talk a little bit more of him in this shortly, but he has one swing thought, which is effectively – he's a big lefty, so he gets his right. He makes sure on his backswing, he makes sure his shoulder touches his chin, which is similar to you to making a full backswing. I think that's pretty much his only one. And from there, he just lets rip, and he's all loose and hands, and he's great to watch. That'll be a similar sort of thing, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Different people have different thoughts, feelings. It's really, I think Curtis Strange was another one of sort of turn his back to the target was, I think, one of his key swing thoughts over the years. And there's a variety of ones. It just depends on who you talk to. But I think the real key is just to find one that works for you and try and keep it as simple as possible. The worst thing you can have out in the golf course is to have four or five and you keep rotating between all of them. The old complete the backswing for me was the best one that I always found. And there was a reason. I imagine it came about that I just knew if I completed my backswing, I found I had a lot of time in the swing to just let it rip from there.
We talked about acceptance of the shot after you've hit it. There's also acceptance before you hit one as well, trusting your swing, trusting your practice, trusting those two or three swing thoughts. It's a great one. I really like that one. Trust the swing and sort of what happens will happen, and you accept the result that's going to come as long as you've done the practice and you've got your swing thoughts and you've done your pre-stroke routine. What happens, what's coming is coming. It's sort of almost out of your hands.
No, it is. I mean, well, one of my favourite sports people, and I was fortunate to play with him in the Dunhill Links many years ago, was Steve Waugh. He's written some great books, you know, about cricket and his rise through the ranks. And I think the culture that he really built into the Australian cricket team was fascinating to me. And part of his philosophy was, you know, you've done the work, now it's just time to back yourself and let it go. And if you do that, usually the success stakes will be in your favour. That was one of his favourite sayings, I think. And I'm sort of on the similar vein where I know I've done the work. It's a matter of trusting yourself and then just letting it go. And look, if it doesn't work out, well, hey, just go back. Maybe you have to go back to the drawing board and work on a few little things, or other times the golfing gods just weren't with you that day. But if you're confident in what you're doing and you're pretty happy with how your game is, things will turn sooner rather than later. And, you know, that bogey train that you might be on, well, you'll get off it pretty soon and you'll throw a few birdies in there. So I think the key really is to just back yourself, because what other choice do you have? It's in certain instances.
Mate, we talked of pre-shot preparation. That's a big theme in your book. But pre-round is important, obviously, as well. Look, mates of mine go out Wednesdays and Saturdays and swear by the pre-round routine of drinking two or three beers and talking shit amongst themselves. obviously, pros and top amateurs are spending a lot of time whacking balls and stretching and eating kale or something before the round. But mentally, how did you get yourself into a good place so that by the time you walked onto that first tee, you know, you were confident in everything? Well, I suppose let's say your hour before your tee time?
Yeah, I think on the tour, guys have varying routines. Some get there a few hours before, or others 30 minutes before, you know, maybe like a Brooks Koepka or someone like that, perhaps. Mm-hmm. For myself, I always found I got to the course usually an hour and a half before my tee time, so I could have a bit of a stretch in the locker room, throw the old sunscreen on and get ready for the day. And my routine consisted of being on the driving range 50 minutes before my tee time. From there, I hit a certain number of balls, did some chipping, putting, hit some bunk shots, all that sort of stuff. But one of the little tips that I always found that worked well for myself was just before I walked to the tee from the practice putting green, I would take a moment to either a minute or 2 minutes just to sort of stand by myself and just gather my thoughts, you know, just kind of close the eyes, take a few deep breaths, and think, okay, what am I out here to do today? Because it's very rare you actually take a little time out or a little break when you're playing golf. You tend to be always thinking about something. And I just found those couple of minutes before I walked to the first tee just settled any nerves I might have, and it kind of gave my mind a nice little focus to go, okay, what am I out here to do today? Let's go do it. Back yourself and let it go. And at that point, I felt composed, ready, and walked to that first tee and sort of, you know, whatever happened after that.
Mate, I did a story for Inside Sport years ago with the great Lucas Parsons, who'd be a peer of yours, about the same vintage, a former Australasian and European Tour pro. He had a year or two on the US PGA Tour. He told me a yarn that he'd had a shocker in the Australian Masters of 2008, I believe it was, on the Thursday, and shot 76 and effectively thought, well, I'm gone. And he went out with some mates and had a feed that evening, and as Lucas does, shared a few bottles of wine and had a fun evening. turned up the next day, hungover, a bit crook, all that sort of stuff. But with expectations effectively zero, after 17 holes, he was 10 under off the stick and a chance to equal the course record. He ended up bogeying the last and shot, I don't know, 63 or whatever it was. And he admits he got away with one there, because you can't do that all the time, of course. But replicating that looseness, I think that's such a key thing in golf, because, you know, Lucas has just gone out, no expectations, and just played golf. How do you replicate that? No consequence, just play. He wasn't in a zone or anything, but he was in a mental place where he had no worries and just played and shot the lights out.
Yeah, I think the no expectations really hits a chord there. I think, you know, Shane Lowry was probably in the same frame of mind when he teed it up in the British Open this year. He wasn't playing all that well before the tournament, I believe. Had a good word with his coach and just thought, well, you know, there's no expectations on you. Just go out there and play. And you know, I'm sure Lucas is probably in the same boat there, although possibly the red wine may have helped or not helped the old swing. Who knows? Maybe that's why I played it well so well at Coolum every year, because of the village square. They had some very nice wines that you'd partake in the night before a round of golf.
So,
but it's certainly not something you want to do on a regular basis. I mean, the idea with golf at the pro level and really at any level is to be as relaxed and as loose as possible when you walk on that first tee. Now, what prepares you the best for that? Well, that's different for every individual. For me, it was taking my time to have a nice warm-up. I mean, one of the things I used to do when I was playing tournaments was I'd actually drive to the course maybe a little slower than I normally would, just so that I wasn't feeling like I was in any rush, because I think that tends to what happens when people don't play as well as they feel rushed when they're playing. There's a sense of urgency, whereas if you're pretty relaxed and cool and calm and easy about things, I think that's when you tend to play your best golf. So, but that no expectations, that's the real key. If you walk onto that first tee thinking, well, I have to shoot, you know, I have to have 40 points today, or I have to win this match to get into the final of my club championship, well, yeah, that's weighing you down pretty heavily. Where if you just go out there, have a bit of fun and think, well, I'll just play my round and whatever score happens, it's funny how those days tend to be the best ones.
Right, so you've wandered up on the tee, you've had your 50 minutes on the range and you've cleared your mind and meditated and whatever, and you're thinking happy thoughts and you're sitting up over that ball and you do your PSR and everything's cool, and then you blaze it out of bounds in front of 20 members or a massive television audience watching you try to win your home open championship, and you feel bad. Nick, how do you turn bad feelings, negative thoughts into positive ones?
That's very easy question, by the way. Yeah, thanks for that one. Well, wouldn't we all like to know the answer? Again, it works differently for everyone. Yep. But speaking from my own point of view, it comes back to that awareness factor of, okay, obviously I'm not thinking the best thoughts right now. If I continue to do that, I'm probably going to hit another bad shot. So how do we turn that around? Well, let's get back to the present moment here. Forget the result. Stick to your process and then let it rip again and commit to that process. You know, the bad ones just tend to come about because you're focusing too much on the result, pure and simple. So I wish there was a more complicated answer that I could give you there, but to be honest, that's about as simple as that one gets.
Well, I reckon there might be a whole other podcast in those provisional balls, and because everyone's provisional seems to smoke down fairway.
That second guy, you know, when you hit that second ball, it's always bang, away you go, because you stand up there, don't really worry about the result and let it rip. So yeah. You know, the proof's in the pudding. Maybe you just need to think as they're hitting a provisional all day. I don't know.
Well, people wanted to buy a box of them in the local pro shop, give us 12 provisionals. Mate, we've just seen Cameron Champ win the Safeway Open on the PGA Tour in the United States. He did it quite emotionally. You know, he played in memory of his granddad, which would seem another thing you couldn't do all the time, to use emotion to drive you. You know, pro golfers have to stay on a pretty even keel. But I suppose it was a way of Cameron sort of playing outside himself or putting the game in perspective or just playing as sort of Lucas Parsons just did. Or did he use it as a driver? Mate, you saw a bit of Cam Champ coming down the stretch. What did you make of him winning that and, you know, using memories of his granddad?
Yeah, it can be a powerful tool in sport. I mean, when you're playing for someone or something else, and in that case, obviously, you know, his granddad and all that was going through there. So he's a phenomenal player, you know, at the best, you know, in everyday golf. So he's just one of those guys that can tear a golf course apart. But I think in the instance of him playing last week, what I noticed was he just felt, or he looked very focused and very composed out on the golf course. He had a goal in mind, obviously, what he was trying to do, and he had his granddad to play for. And perhaps when things were getting away from him, you know, maybe in his mind he had that kind of verbal slap in the face of, hey, you know, granddad doesn't want you to do that. Let's refocus and get back to the job at hand. So, as I say, it's a very powerful thing, I think, in sport when you're playing for something and someone else, because usually you are playing for yourself, which is obviously not a bad thing, but in golf, being a very individual sport, sometimes it's just nice to have that outside influence that can really kick your butt along the way onto the right path. And obviously that happened for him. And to play the way he did coming down the stretch was incredibly impressive.
I want to throw some golfers' names at you. I've got three or four little names here, blokes you've played with. and against? Firstly, the great Tiger Woods, of course, because of all the golfers you've played with over the years, I'd imagine Tiger would have the greatest mental capacity to shut out the outside world and focus. And I know that's sort of riveting insight from me, but from watching him up close and on the TV and on the range, and you know he's been in the public eye a long time. What does he do right mentally that our listeners could apply in the next round?
I think the Tiger's greatest strength is he's able to do on a back nine on a Sunday what most players can do on the front nine on a Thursday.
Oh, yeah.
If we're talking about tour pros, you know, when tournament starts out, people are composed, they're going through their routines, no problem at all. And as the tournament progresses and the later it gets into the event, you know, when you come crunch time, some players just get out of their routines and they don't execute as they would earlier in the tournament. Tiger, it just looks as though the 72nd hole is the same as the 6th hole or the 27th hole or whatever it is. And that's the difference between, I think, the good and the great players. I talk a bit about that in the book, where the difference being the great players can execute the fundamentals when the pressure is at its greatest, whereas the good players perhaps struggle in those situations. And Tiger obviously has that aura about him of invincibility. You know, in his heyday, I remember being in the States and they had the ESPN Sports Center always going and they'd always have a top 10 of Tiger's greatest hits and greatest wins. And that almost fed the aura and the ego that he had, because every time he turned the TV on, he just saw greatness. So it was a pretty cool thing for him to continue watching. And I'm sure it made him feel invincible. And it obviously played that way over his career. So, you know, his ability to just focus on one shot at a time and keep his mind dedicated to that moment is very impressive. I think, you know, one of the greatest putts I've ever seen was him when he had that putt on the 72nd hole of the US Open.
Yep.
I think it was 2008 total,
yep.
To tie Rocco Media,
yep.
To go into a playoff. And, I mean, that green was so bumpy. If you look at the slow-mo of the ball rolling down the green. And I remember someone asking him about that putt afterwards, and they said, well, how did you hold that putt? And he says, well, all I tried to do was just put a good roll on the ball. And if I did that, if the ball went in, it's obviously my day. If it didn't, well, what more could I do? And that kind of goes back to the philosophy we were talking about earlier of acceptance. And he's possibly done some meditation and things like that over the years, which has obviously helped him have that philosophy as well and that mindset. So it was pretty impressive, and I'll never forget that putty hold that day.
Wouldn't it be nice to get home and have a beer and then turn on the ESPN and see a highlight reel of your round of golf and how good you've been going, just to have that?
Yep, 24/7, that'd be good.
Mate, my two favourite golf swings belong to Freddie Couples and Ernie Els, just that beautiful, languid powerful swings, and it looks effortless and it looks aesthetically very pleasing. And those two guys seem to wander the course pretty cool too. Ernie goes by the name Big Easy, of course, which he doesn't actually like apparently, because it doesn't speak to how hard he worked to get, you know, to make it look so easy. But what about the great Ernie's mental application to golf, and I suppose life even too, do you admire and that our listeners can apply in their Saturday round?
Yeah, Ernie's one of the hardest workers out there as well. You know, you see him big, tall, strong, and the swing looks effortless, but has been a lot of hours gone into that. Don't you worry about that. And he's actually one of my favorite players to play with because of his rhythm and his relaxed manner. I mean, I think I've played with him half a dozen times over my career, and the worst score I've ever shot is 4 or 5 under playing with him.
Wow.
It's just, you know, that rhythm just rubs off on you, and it's just fantastic to watch. And then between shots, it's always fun with him as well, because you can talk about cricket and rugby or whatever the, you know, sport South Africa and Australia are playing at that time. So, you know, what everyone can take away about Ernie's game, I think, is just the complete rhythm and relaxed nature to it. I mean, when he swings a driver, it's like he's swinging a 7-iron. So for the everyday golfer out there, that's a huge key as far as the physical game goes, is to, when you get a driver in your hand, just feel as though you're hitting the mid-iron, basically, because the club's going to do the work for you, and that's why it'll go further than your other clubs. But I think his relaxed nature out there and the way he walks down the fairways is always fun to watch as well. The old people dragging their buggies down the local club comps, they kind of hunched over and rushing to get to their ball. Maybe just take your time a little more, just enjoy the walk and chat with the playing partners and have a look at the birds and the trees a bit more. That might be the best thing to take away from Ernie's game, I reckon.
Bryson DeChambeau seems at the other end of the spectrum there. He looks very technical. He looks almost the opposite to Ernie and Freddie. He seems stiff to me, but it's obviously an approach that's very idiosyncratic to him and works for him, obviously. What about, you know, his physical approach, technical approach, we can all see on the golf course, but what about his mental approach? Observing him, do you note, and again, can our listeners apply?
Well, I think he's playing to his personality, which is obviously working very well for him. He's a very studious, methodical, analytical person by nature. I don't know how many degrees he must have in probably biochemical engineering and things like that. I'm not quite sure, but you know, he's using that capacity to his fullest when he plays the game of golf, taking in every factor of wind direction, earth rotation, humidity, you name it. He has it covered in his yardage book, I'm sure. Now, that's not going to work for a lot of players, myself included, but it certainly works for him. So I think the key there that you take away is that he's playing to his personality and what he does in everyday life, he does on the golf course, and all credit to him. I wish he'd play it a little bit quicker, but, you know, he has his own opinions on that as well. So I'm not going to argue with the guy. He's won several times on the PGA Tour. So I'm sure he'll just keep doing what he's doing.
Mentioned Bubba Watson. He's one of my favourite players to watch, the big lefty just whacking and hitting, cutting the corners off dog legs. I love watching him play 13 at Augusta. It's just great fun. Yeah, look, he does seem to make mental errors that you list in your book, and that he'll walk a full fairway carrying a bad shot and getting stuck into his caddy and moaning and whinging about stuff and cursing, you know, the golfing gods and all that. But he's obviously ridiculously talented, very exciting to watch. But and I'm sure you're loath to give Bubba any advice, given he, you know, he's won the Masters a couple of times and he does quite well. But if Bubba said to you, Nick, I would like to be mentally stronger and forget my bad shots more easily, what would you say to him? Couple of beers?
Yeah, who knows? Bubba's a very unique guy. You know, I'm not sure he hits a lot of balls. He probably plays most days rather than practices on the range, to be honest. So he's, you know, when it comes to golf, he's more an artist than a scientist, as we, you know, he's at the other end of the spectrum to Bryson. But with Bubba, I think one of his great strengths, and some people may see it as a weakness, is he never blames himself. If he misses a putt, well, it's got to be the caddy's misread or someone else's fault. So there's almost no accountability there. So in a way, that can be good and bad, and it seems to work for him. The one thing it does do for him is I think it makes him very streaky, because when he's on, he's unbelievably on. And when he's off, well, he can also have some pretty horrendous results as well. So if I was perhaps caddying for him, I think the best thing to say to Bubba might be, after he does hit a bad shot, is to just get his mind off golf right there and then, because he's a bit OCD, I believe, where his mind just goes at a million miles an hour. So if he can channel it into the right direction, and rather than complaining about a golf shot, maybe he can chat about the local stock car racing or whatever he loves to do. So it's a matter, I think, with Bubba, of occupying his mind of something other than what he just did. And the sooner you do that, the better, I reckon. That might be my best advice for him. But hey, he's won two Masters, and I'm not going to say anything there, because that golf course suits him down to the ground if he putts well, and he obviously did on two occasions.
Mate, we're only just the one podcast deep, or now two. Our Ask Nick segments are pretty bare, so I've got one. You mentioned your caddy Wilbur. You use him as a sounding board throughout the round, as much for having a yarn between shots as to what club, wind direction, putting lines, all that sort of stuff. Now, with apologies to Wilbur and all the pro loopers, I've got a sort of philosophical problem with professional players leaning on caddies in a round, making them feel better. I think a round of golf should be man versus field, golf course conditions, and if you have a little mate make you feel better, it doesn't prove who's the best at it. But it's a whole other podcast. I'm shouting into the wind anyway. But the amateur player equivalent to having a good caddy is playing with your mates, and you've mentioned now having a yarn as you're walking around the course, but you don't always play with your mates, and I'm sure golfer and caddy don't always get on. You know, being like teenage brother and sister, or husband and wife, you can have your arguments. How do you fashion a fun and decent round if your caddy / playing partners are a pain in the ass?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, you obviously need to pick better playing partners, but sometimes you can't, can you?
Yeah,
and my caddy and I over the years, Wilbur, I mean, we almost became like brothers out there, because we spent so much time together. He was one of my best mates. But we still had the odd Barney, you know, where I might have told him to go somewhere that he shouldn't. Because I'd had enough of him talking to me. But I think the main thing that you can work on if you're playing with someone possibly you don't like or your caddy's annoying you is just to either get away from them and just switch off and you know, start thinking about other things and walk to yourself. Or if that's not possible, try and find some common ground with them and some shared interests and start talking about something other than golf, because obviously that's what's annoying you, probably about maybe the way they play or if they're a bit slow or something like that. And you might be able to talk about something that might speed them up a little, who knows. But yeah, at the end of the day, maybe you just hope the 4 hours goes a little quicker than what it normally should.
But also day, beer.
But try and play with your mates. That might be a good lesson, who knows. So, but anyway, that's a tough one to answer.
Yeah, 100%. All right, we'll wrap it up pretty soon, mate. Listeners, as we said earlier, a segment for this podcast is going to be hashtag Ask Nick, in which any of you can ask the man a question. It could be about course management, first tee jitters, as we mentioned, how many schooners pre-round, et cetera. But again, get on to myself, Matt, at mattcleary.com or care of nickohearn.com or on the Twitters at journomattcleary, 1T, at nickohearn. Use that hashtag Ask Nick. Hashtag. We're on Facebook as well. Or I don't know if you just see Nick around at the Victorian PGA where he's going to play, the Aussie Open where he's going to play. I'm sure he'll be mooching around the President's Cup. And I hope to be as well. Ask us a question and we'll factor it into the show. Also, Nick, as people may or may not know, is available for mentorship and of Promising Young Pros. You can have a yak about his book around. He does corporate stuff. And if you're seeking tips about the mental side of golf from a player's perspective rather than a sports psych person's, obviously listen to this podcast, or get in touch with Nick, care of his website, nickohearn.com, or email me, matt@mattcleary.com, or again, say hello on the Twitters and Facebook, and we'll see how we go there. Righto, that's us. Thanks, Nick. What's on for your weekend, mate? Do you get out and play in Woodlands Stableford comp on a Saturday or the Par comp on Wednesdays, or do you play...
Yeah, every once in a while I do. I can't this Saturday. I'm actually playing at a cathedral on Sunday. I don't know if you know much about that golf course. A couple of hours outside of Melbourne, a great track out there. Going to play an event out there and also do a clinic maybe Friday night at Albert Park, the driving range, which should be a bit of fun.
Righto, that's us. Thanks for listening, golf fans. Any questions, again, hashtag Ask Nick on the Twitters. And if you're able to apply one of these lessons successfully or otherwise in your round this weekend, do let us know. We are here to help and we'd be very curious to see if any of this gibber actually has an effect on golfers, particularly on how you enjoy your game of golf. I'm sure it is. Look, you know, if you're a golfer, a lot of this is sort of almost common sense stuff. But like, you know, Bob Rotella's book, which is probably the best of the literary genre, it is common sense, but you know, you have it explained in a nice way, as Nick can do. It does help you play golf. My book would be, of course, To a Mental Case. So that's us. Righto. Good on you, folks. See ya. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again. Bye for now.